OPN Ask an Angel podcasts are conversations with global angel investors and venture capitalists. We explore how to invest, understanding investment strategies and approaches to due diligence. Join us and learn what it takes to be a startup or what it takes to invest in the next great company.
No worries.
Welcome to the Supporters Fund Ask an Investor. I'm your host, Jeffrey Poffin. Let's please welcome Anthony Cho, founder at Providence Growth Stage Investment Group, as our investor today. Welcome, Anthony. It's a real pleasure having you join us.
Thanks for having me, Jeffrey. I'm excited to be chatting.
Likewise. I'm pretty excited about this for many reasons, but the main one that really stands out for me is that we don't always get the opportunity to dive in and chat with an investor with your level of experience, but also the fact that you're in CPG. And I'm a huge fan of that category. Not only because I worked in it through many, many years as a kid working at Loblaws all the way through to working at the head office and building products and then being obviously on the tech side. But man, there's such a tough space to really find businesses that can thrive. And there's so many that start up every day and they just don't seem to get to where they need to. And I'm going to say you have all the answers, Anthony. I believe you have all of them and we're excited to learn about those today. So we're going to kick this off by first, love you to share a little bit about your background. Please go all the way back to your Harvard days. I think that's important through all of the different types of businesses that you've operated, worked in, director in, and of course, today what Providence is all about. And then one thing about you that nobody would know.
Yeah, for sure. So I'll actually go one step earlier than my Harvard days. So I got the entrepreneurial bug from my father, actually. And interesting that you spent time at Loblaws because my dad was, by hook or crook in one way or the other in retail businesses his entire life. I think the most meaningful experience he had, right before I went to college was he became a franchisee of Texaco, which was a big oil company. And it was right when the gas stations were being converted from service stations to really convenience stores that had, gas stations as kind of the front end draw. And so he was considered one of the best operators in the system. And I tried to understand what the heck that meant when everyone had the same draw at the front end and everyone's gas prices were exactly the same. Like, how do you make the back of that house, that convenience store, actually operate better than your competition? So got the bug there. Even though I was Southern California raised my entire life, I decided to go to the East Coast and go to Harvard because I felt like if I never left California at that point, I probably would never leave. And once I saw brick in the sidewalk, I realized this is a different place. I've got to see it. I've got to experience it. And I'm really glad I did. But I still couldn't get that entrepreneurial bug out of my blood while I was there. So my roommates and I, we all started an on-campus eatery. And let's just say the first 6 months were an incredible success. We thought we were really brilliant. And then we went away for holiday, came back, and two other restaurants had opened up on campus nearby. And I've learned very quickly the importance of having some barriers to entry around your business. So that's always been in my blood. And post Harvard, I knew I wanted to do something that would train me to learn part of that entrepreneurial journey. And so I chose investment banking, not because I loved finance per se. It was a path to learn as much as I could, as quickly as I could. And I didn't mind not sleeping, not eating, not working out, or whatever the case might be. I just wanted to learn as much as I could in 2 years. So so I was very fortunate while I was slaving away on Wall Street in New York. I got a call from a firm called Brentwood Associates out in LA. And I'd never heard of them, but I heard two things. I heard LA and private equity. And back then, it's you could count on one hand how many private equity firms were in LA. And even though I wasn't looking to leave New York at that moment, I you know, when there weren't that many firms in LA, I felt like it was a unique opportunity to get back to the hometown and start doing what I thought would be super interesting. So joined Brentwood in 1996 and was there for 20 years. And I was very fortunate because one of the co-founders of the firm made me his right hand in 2006, handed the keys to the strategy to me at that point. And that's when I focused the firm entirely on brands selling direct to the end consumer in multiple channels. And it was a really difficult strategy to explain to our LPs in 2006. So I wrote a 120-page white paper deck explaining why e-commerce was going to be transformative for brands, but they, in order to scale, they were all going to have to be omni-channel, and omni-channel is really complex and difficult. So all of them are going to need help. So the good news is that strategy turned out pretty well. So our that fund that we raised around 2006, it's about a $400 million fund, became a top quartile performer. Even though we were half deployed before the Great Recession, our brands had extraordinary resilience during that time. And that was kind of the proof in the pudding of both the omni-channel strategy, but also the fact that brand matters. And there was no better test than going through the most severe downturn since the Great Depression to prove that brand matters. So we were on our way. By 2016, 10 years later, we'd become much larger. We were about to become a $1 billion fund. But I felt like the world had changed. And to me, the most interesting sweet spot of the growth curve for consumer brands had actually shifted smaller, earlier, and minority, not bigger, later, and majority. And I felt like having too much capital was going to put us further and further away from that sweet spot. So I felt very strongly that we should raise a growth sidecar internally to be able to participate in the next generation of great brands. And everybody else wanted to keep it simple and stay focused on getting bigger. And so at that point, I said, I wish you guys the best. If you guys don't want to do this, then I'm going to do this and launch Provenance. But before launching Provenance, one of the things I did was spent about 6 months stitching together a bunch of data tools that we use today that I felt like were critical to really understand at a granular level what's going on at the next generation of brands. So we do predictive analytics, as well as layering on all kinds of demographic and psychographic information. And we do that by asking companies for access to their full transaction log and customer file so we can do all this work. That was a little bit of an experiment in the same way that back in 2006, focusing on omni-channel brands was a bit of an experiment, but it's turned out even better than I could have hoped. So we're super excited about what we're doing today, and we hope to keep doing it for a long time.
Oh, that's awesome. Before we dive into all of this, one thing about you that nobody would know.
One thing that nobody would know is starting a little over 20 years ago as a hobby, I started DJing in nightclubs on Saturday nights. And for me, it was just a way to have a creative outlet. And I only did it once a week on Saturday nights because I knew no matter what my travel schedule looked like during the week, I would always be back home on a Saturday, and I wouldn't miss a gig. So something I still toy around with today. I don't do it in clubs anymore. I just do it for my own enjoyment. Again, just to exercise the right hemisphere of my brain and stay connected to my creative side.
That's a great story. One of a colleague or friend in Beirut, investor, he does the same. He literally had done it a long time ago and then decided later on to pick it back up again. So he went and bought everything, started working on it again. He loves it. He's like, I'll do weddings, I'll do anything. He's like, I just enjoy the atmosphere and going in and doing that. So I love the fact that you're talking to it, being at your creative side or your creative brain to get that out. And I love that. That's awesome.
Yeah, I hope to never stop. So, but I will probably never do it in a club environment ever again.
It's still fun, though. I think that's the key. And you're getting people interested in the music and what you're doing. So your creative arts side. So that's pretty cool. To go back to kind of the, I think we'll start on the entrepreneurial side. And what I love about this is that, as you mentioned earlier on, that you had this bug to kind of do something and you went and jumped into it right away with your roommates. And then you learned kind of 6 months in when you took the break that competition's going to come out of nowhere. And what moat did you build around kind of what you structured? So there's a lot of learnings you can take from that. Are there a couple of things that you left that environment with outside of losing, say, money and time? But is there something that came out of it that said, you know what, in the future, I'm always going to make sure I'm cognizant of these three things because it's important, even today, what I learned from that short experience?
Yeah, I think the primary lesson was, I think we were very wise to see that there was an opening in the marketplace, there was a need for it. And the context was, there's an area at Harvard called the Quad, where there were three dorms that were clustered a little bit further afield from the rest of campus and a little bit further away from Harvard Square. So, you know, when you got the late night munchies, there was no convenient place to go. And so it was very obvious to us with at least three dorms there that, you know, there'd be sufficient demand. So, so we're wise to see the opening there, but not realizing the same advantages that we had, which was our dorm had some kitchen equipment that was being underused, a space that was being underused. We didn't have to buy any of that. We just had to step in and get approval to get it started. Didn't realize that the other three dorms had the exact same setup. And so once we showed people the idea, it was pretty easy for the other two dorms to allow the same thing to happen. But it was fun because we decided that we weren't just going to serve food. We were going to create an environment around it. So whether it was a movie night or having bands play or just kind of having it be a social hub of the Quad, it was really fun. And we achieved our goal for the first half of that year. When we came back, it was very obvious that, you know, there's a certain energy and a density to what's happening. So when it got spread out, it didn't have that same social hub sense of it. And so it wasn't that we were losing money, but when you don't have that excitement and that emotional energy that's in the same place by the density of people that's there, it's not the same business. And, you know, in many ways, that feeling of, you know, people being excited about what's happening, whether that's a restaurant or whether that's a brand, you know, the same concept applies.
Well, it's interesting the way you take the approach that instead of looking at what were the major losses to the opportunity, you looked at it from what was the gain. And I think that's important because the gain here was, to your point, was that you learned a lot from this experience, from a social side, but also commercializing, that once you guys came back, the space became commercialized. It became a business opportunity for other people to also see the gap, also see the efficiencies. So they were able to dive in and pull those apart. So I guess the break is probably a good thing because it let you see things a bit differently. But what I really liked about that approach that you took was that also when you created this, there was a gap. And this is what created your entrepreneurial side, is that you were sitting around saying, hey, there's a lack of X. Maybe we should do something. And one, you actually did it. So that's 99% better than the rest of the world that doesn't take that same leap of faith. But you found a way to make it work and then socialize it so that other people found the same impact. So in that 6 months, you probably learned more than people may learn in years of working in business because one, you took the extra step to do it, but you also saw something that others didn't see for the 10, 20, 30, 50 years before you, which was that there was a gap, there was underutilized equipment, there was space. So there was all of these factors that tied together to create that entity, even if it was short-lived. That was super impactful and it changed those people's lives for that 6 months. And I think this goes back to a lot of the things that you're doing today when it gets into CPG, branding, tribe, but there's a lot of things that come out of what that moment probably carried. So now you kind of move forward into Which I love hearing this term because it was coined back in, you know, the late 90s or early 2000s, which was this omni-channel experience. And I'll add in the experience side because I really think that that helps you better understand what omni-channel really is. And maybe you could dive into what omni-channel means to you today than it did probably when you first started, because there certainly wasn't as many channels back then to utilize in that experience that you had, but you tried to push this forward in the last fund that you were raising, of course. But what was the end goal to this omni-channel experience that you kind of taken and jumped into fully today?
Yeah, so omni-channel has been talked about. Yeah, you're exactly right, Jeffrey, for probably 20 years at this point. And the reality is in the early days of it, for at least the first 10, it wasn't really omni-channel, it was multi-channel. So you had silos of, maybe I'll have my e-commerce operations, but it would operate very separately from your retail operations or your wholesale operations. Everything was extremely siloed, but that was the beginnings of the first step towards becoming truly omni-channel. And, but I think today we're much closer to that. And we see it in all of our companies. And what allows you to be more truly omni-channel is understanding how the customer migrates from various channels. And it's really true, the customers don't stay static. And you have to be everywhere that the customer is, and you have to understand how that's happening. So so that was foundational to launching Provenance. And what was also foundational was getting brands to trust us that if we have access to the data, we can help you unpack what's actually happening at an omni-channel level. So I think the first time we really had a complicated exercise to do this with was with an apparel brand called Marine Layer. And Marine Layer is based in San Francisco. We invested in it in 2018, and it was doing about $35 million of revenue at that time. They were scrappy, and they had retail stores, their own e-commerce. They had no wholesale back then, but they were doing it at a break-even level, and they were very religious about not wasting money in any way, which we philosophically very much align with. And we first started talking to them, they said, we're about to do an omni-channel analytics exercise. And I said, great, that's fantastic. What are you looking for? And they said, we're not quite sure yet, but we think we need to do it. And we said, well, fantastic. That's what we've actually been set up to do. So why don't we take that off your plate? If you give us access to your data, give us a few weeks with it, and we'll come back to you and show you what's happening. And so we showed them a variety of different things, but we were able to map out that omni-channel journey, what the lifetime value of the customer was that started retail first and then became an e-com customer, or somebody who started e-com first and then became a retail customer, or any direction or any single channel, we could map out the lifetime value of the customer in any one of those journeys. But what was probably more important than mapping all that out was helping them understand who their tribe was. And so one of the things we showed them was that they have a very distinct tribe of consumers. And when we say tribe, what we're talking about is a very specific psychographic profile. And so we showed them a variety of things about what's very unique about their tribe. And when we first showed them this, and this is the reaction we get from every company, it's almost comical now how similar the reaction is. Everybody's a little bit disappointed because they look at that tribe and their first reaction is, well, what about all the other customers? What about all the other consumers across the US? We want to access and be relevant to them too. And said, don't worry, your tribe is large enough that it won't impact your ultimate scale. But trust us, when you have this tribe, it's actually a good thing because it means you're not a commodity. It means you're resonating very strongly with a specific subset, and you want to stay true to who that customer is. And when we scale, we're going to stay focused on that subset of consumers, and we're just going to, it's going to help us be more efficient in building each one of our channels by staying true to who that tribe is. And, you know, sure enough, we're now 5 years into the journey with them, or getting close to it. We're like 4.5 years into that journey. You know, by the end of this year, we'll probably be 4x the size of where we were in 2018, and very profitable. That tribe is exactly the same as it was 4 years ago. We're just reaching more of them. And that's the foundational piece for why we do what we do, is in the consumer space, you've seen it, Jeffrey, that there's an incredible amount of brand fragmentation in every category of consumer spending. Doesn't matter whether it's food, beauty, apparel, home, you name it. There's way more brands today than there ever used to be. And so what our whole hypothesis was, categories are getting fragmented, not into subcategories, but into tribes. And different tribes are going to, you know, appeal to different types of customers. And so therefore, we think it's a permanent state of fragmentation. And so I think the end state of brands is just going to be smaller than it used to be. So it's going to be hard to build the next Ralph Lauren, where you're multi-billions of dollars of revenue. You know, it's the next generation of brands has to be much more tightly focused, much more specific about who they're trying to appeal to. And a lot of that's driven by the fact that barriers to entry have never been lower. And but what we like to tell brands is, at the same time, barriers to excellence have never been higher, because being truly omnichannel is incredibly difficult. And you have to put in the hard work to make it omnichannel. And just to bring it back to the marine layer example, one of the exercises we went through in a few years ago and really started to bear fruit in 2021 was when we truly tied together all of our inventory and could really service every channel from wherever we had inventory, we were able to grow our revenue by $32 million that year and grew our inventory by under $3 million to support that. We just became more efficient with it. And that's the power of being truly omnichannel. But it's not easy to get there. You have to do a lot of work to truly make it happen.
Wow, this is pretty exciting. So taking the omnichannel approach for, say, an early stage brand. So take the companies doing 5 to 10 million. They're finding their tribe. They're figuring out who they are. What is some of the advice that there's going to be a lot of pitfalls? People are trying to source differently. They've got operations working in different states. They're bringing product in, say, from China or Mexico, wherever it might be. And they're trying to really level the playing field so that they can get their product out to market. Their brand is probably not in the best spot. We all think it is, but just like everything, your team changes a lot early on and all the way through your business, your brand will shift all the way through that time as well. So What are some of the advice pieces that you would say, you know what, focus on this, make sure you master this piece first, then start to branch out. And the example I'll share is that in some of the companies that we invest in or operate in, they come out with, say, 7 products. They're like, we're going to market with 7. Maybe there should be 3 or 2, or maybe it's 1 for today. Let's just figure out who your tribe is first, because the 7's great, but that's hard to get shelf space. But there's a misunderstanding of what that actually means, or is that even possible? So are there a few things that you could share that would really kind of help people understand this omni-channel approach and when they should be executing on this? And what should they do before they get to that stage? Which means, what should they be doing before they get to you?
Yeah, for sure. That is an awesome question. So we like to chat with companies well before they're ready for our stage. So maybe I'll start with what our typical stage is. So we usually like to get involved with brands somewhere between the $20 to $70 million of revenue level. That's how we define the growth stage of a brand. And for us, that's, we jokingly refer to it as the awkward, gangly adolescent phase, where you're not a startup anymore, but you're not a mature business anymore. You know what the DNA is going to produce, but it's not a fully formed adult yet. That's the part that we embrace. One step before that is when you're really trying to figure out, you know, whether it's product market fit, pricing, brand positioning, all those things. At the $5 million stage, usually there's a couple things that happen. One is, we always like to say that almost every brand starts with a hero product. The brand becomes synonymous with, you know, one great thing that you're producing, and word of mouth starts to spread. That's how you build your reputation. That's how you get started. But everything about what your brand is over the long haul is a function of what you do next after that original hero product. Where you decide to go from a product perspective or a channel perspective or both has everything to do with what you're doing there after that initial hero. How do you build the assortment? What direction is the assortment going? Because you've captured people's fancy and you've captured their attention, and they're now watching what you're doing next, and that evolution will define your brand for years to come. So there's no one right choice for every brand. For some folks, it's to stay very tightly assorted with a limited focus and just own a handful of products that they do better than everyone else. For others, it's to broaden the assortment. There's a brand halo that allows them to do a lot more, and they don't necessarily have to be best in class at every new product that they introduce, but you know, the brand values and principles allow people to enjoy lots of different things from it. So that's number one, is what you decide to do after you find that initial hero product. Because usually you have to have something resembling a hero product to get to that $5 to $10 million revenue stage. The second thing we always like to tell brands is, once you're in that zone, $5 to $10 million, you can identify your tribe, and that tribe stays locked in. Even at that scale, it becomes incredibly difficult to appeal to a tribe that's different than that. So we've actually done free work for a company that we were never invested in, but we tracked them from 5 million in revenue to 25 to 125. They would expand their product assortment, they would expand their channels. And every time they did that, they would say, surely our tribe has changed at this point. I'd say, trust us, it hasn't, but we'll do the work for you just to prove that it hasn't. And once they got north of 100 million in revenue, they stopped asking us to refresh the analytics, because they realized what we were telling them was true, that their tribe stayed exactly the same. So I think it's really important for brands to know what that tribe is at as early a stage as possible, because once you do that, all your choices in the future become much clearer. Like what you're going to do, what you're not going to do, what products are going to resonate and which ones aren't, what values are going to resonate. So for example, lots of brands lean into sustainability, which we strongly support. But in many cases, we see that the customer base doesn't actually care. In other cases, we see they care quite a bit. And the company isn't talking about it enough, about how much they care as well. So that was one of the things we showed Marine Layer, was that they have a customer base that cares passionately about the environment and sustainability. And they were doing lots of things that were benefiting that. So they were using some of the most sustainable fabrics on the planet. They were trying to use as many sustainable processes as they could cost efficiently, but they weren't talking about it at all. So we said, whether or not you do this deal with us, we strongly encourage that you start talking about your values here, because it's clear that it's part of your value system. Your customer wants to hear that from you. So 3 months after we closed the deal with them, they launched this program called Respun, which recycles old garments back into new yarns, new fabrics, and ultimately new garments. And you know, that first holiday season when they launched it, they had budgeted to get 10,000 t-shirts back to be recycled. They ended up getting 140,000 back. And 40% of the respondents to that program were entirely new customers. So clearly what had happened was it resonated really strongly with that tribe. That tribe started to tell their friends about it, and their friends started participating in it. And it kind of took on a life of its own. And so this is what we mean by tribe, and really identifying it and, you know, staying true to that tribe. It's not like Marine Layer was just invented these values. These values were already embedded in how they were operating, but it makes it very clear what they should do and shouldn't do from a strategic perspective. So yeah, I can go on and on about different examples of staying true to your tribe as you grow, but it just allows you to focus in ways that that you don't have to worry about if you're chasing TAM. So we always like to say, you have a tribe, not a TAM. So don't try to go after the entire market. If you stay true to who your most loyal customers are, you'll grow beyond what you think is possible.
I like it. This is great. So to go back to you mentioned a couple of terms, values, persona. I threw persona in there because all of this kind of wraps around that whole ideal of what is the persona of the customer you're going after. I think if you define that persona, that's what's going to open up this tribe, right? And you're trying to figure out yourselves who that persona is, but you're utilizing data in order to do that.
That's
so right. You're kind of doing a little bit of, I'm sure there's a lot of market analysis, but you're really diving into who that consumer is, why they're buying, how many times they buy, and there's probably 8 million other KPIs and metrics that tie into that, which help you build this persona. And it makes me remember back in my Loblaws days when we were doing building out the e-commerce online platforms for Joe and Joe Fresh and a few of the other platforms. And we had this major persona of who the main buyer was. Yep. And we got in front of all the management in Loblaws company and we said, hey, this is the persona. She's a female. She's, you know, 42, has 3 kids, it does X, Y, and Z. And we're launching perfumes in the market and we're going to launch clothing. And everybody's like, clothing? Who wants to buy their clothes from Loblaws? And, you know, they set the target for $1 billion in 5 years. And man, they blew that out in 3. So Why was that the case? And they came up with this ideal value to what this persona was. And what the persona was of this person was, I'm shopping, but I need other things. And I can't get those other things because I have kids. I got to go somewhere else. So maybe if we layer them in there, I can layer them into my receipt. And then It'll just look like I did a grocery shop. So I spent $300 today on groceries. So don't be upset. But here's all of the value that came from it. And I got the kids' clothes and I did all these other things. So that was what tied into bringing in all of these other elements into the product. And they were bang on to say that this was the persona of who they're going after. And don't worry about anybody else. Just focus on that. And that made a massive difference, because even if it was only 20% of their customer, they generated 60% of the value that was going through that shop every day. So I'm assuming that's what you're trying to really pull from.
Yeah, that is 100% correct. So personas are what we're helping create for brands. I think what's different about how we do it is, you know, the more traditional way of creating personas is by doing surveys. And, you know, you always survey work, if you're doing it the right way, is you have to be incredibly disciplined about who you're sampling. Is there a sample selection bias that's coming from response bias or other things? And the data that we're layering on, we're typically able to attribute it to probably, you know, 70% of the customer base at a very specific level. So it's not everyone, but it's the vast majority of consumers. And that's why I think it ends up being pretty accurate. And so when we're talking about persona creation, we, with our brands, we say, you know, the persona that we're helping define based on who your individual customers are, it's almost like your unique fingerprint or DNA of your brand. And every brand is slightly different. There can be lots of similarities in, you know, types of consumers you're trying to reach, but that unique mix is your unique fingerprint. So let us help you identify what that means. And, you know, two stories that come to mind. We, last year we invested in an eyewear business called Caddis. So I happen to be wearing Caddis right now. It's kind of premium. It started as premium readers for my generation, which is Gen X. And we're a very brand savvy generation, but nobody markets to us anymore. Yet we're at the peak of our disposable income and wealth curves. And so Caddis is just trying to, you know, capture that customer that ain't quite dead yet, doesn't feel quite dead yet. in fact, quite the opposite, and is resonating with them. In any event, when we did this analytics exercise for them, the founder was very much came from a brand environment, having worked at Burton Snowboards, Patagonia, like he bled brand. And the reason why he chose to partner with us is after doing this analytics exercise, we described the brand to him and what we thought it meant. And he just stared at us saying, "You are the first party that has ever articulated my brand to me better than I could do it myself. How did you guys do that?" And we just said, "Well, we can see who your tribe is. And when we know who your tribe is, we know why you're resonating with them and what you mean." So that was just our interpretation of it. So yeah, for us, we kind of view it as, you know, medicine has evolved. In many ways, the practice hasn't, but the technology has. So, you know, in the old days of medicine, you'd walk into your, you know, primary care physician's office, he'd have his, you know, rubber mallet and stethoscope and ask you, "Where does it hurt?" And otherwise there was no conversation. Well, we kind of make the analogy that we're kind of starting this process with a full body MRI scan, and we're showing you certain things that you may not even feel or recognize yet, but you should be aware of because they may become issues in the future. To us, this just makes sense, because if we're trying to give the best advice possible to our companies, generic advice today is not worth a whole lot. We're giving very specific advice that's very tailored to each one of our companies based on who their tribe is. And so all of our growth strategies for our companies are very unique. They're not all following the same growth plan. And the only way we feel confident about giving very specific advice is if we have very specific information and data. So that's one piece of it. I think the other piece that requires this level of precision is that, you know, one of the things that we've noticed in aggregate is that we've seen many tens of millions of underlying households in the US. And what's a little bit surprising for a lot of people, but it's not surprising to us, is that 18% of households account for 63% of the brand spend. And it very much mirrors discretionary income. And so, you know, most brands are targeting that 18%. And you have to be very specific about which 18% you're starting with and you're carving out mindshare from, because they have a lot of choice. And if you're not laser focused on my brand is this, but it's not this, if you're not true to your tribe, you're going to end up missing everyone. You'll miss the mark on everyone. So, yeah, we always like to say, trying to be all things to all people will result in meaning nothing to everyone. And that's the kiss of death today. So it's better to be smaller, more narrowly focused especially on that tribe, and then you have a chance to win.
I love it, and it's so true. And I think just to add into some of the details that you shared, I think a lot of that persona KPIs, it comes down to a lot of different details, and those could be, I think you mentioned some of them, like if they are ESG based. It's really diving into the brand. What does the brand represent, and what does it represent to the people that are buying it? And what are the commonalities between all of the people that are buying that brand that you can then take that back and say, look, you have to stop talking about ESG when your brand isn't representing that to your consumer and they're the ones buying it. So we need to change that around to people that enjoy the beach or enjoy sports. And this is the market that's really focused on you. So let's drive into that more and build that out. So if that's how you're going to build the nest egg or the group of buyers that you have, and keep catering to them, because everybody else you're trying to cater to is fitting outside the spectrum. And yeah, you're getting some auxiliary sales, but they're not bringing enough value to where your core is. And that tribe is really going to define this over the next 3 to 5 years, if you can really hone in on this persona. And this will save you money on marketing, operations, trying products that you don't need to try because they're not going to get sold very well under your brand. So we can say, you know what, don't go to a CBD. It's not going to help you. Your consumer is already shopping for that and buying it. So focus on this area.
You are 100% correct. That is exactly. It's about growing efficiently. It's not growth at all costs. It's not profit at all costs. It's trying to find that right balance of continuing to reach more and more of that tribe. And yeah, that's the message we've been preaching, which, you know, in the last 10 years, I think the world has gone from guardrail to guardrail on, you know, 10 years ago was profit and EBITDA at all costs. Then over the last decade, it migrated to growth at all costs, EBITDA be damned. And now it feels like the investment landscape is searching for, well, what are we solving for? Is it growth? Is it profitability? Which one is it? And that's the question we all often get asked by brands is, which one do you care about more? And we just say, yes, we care about both. It's about how you balance that. And balancing that while staying true to the tribe as you grow. If you do that, then you can grow efficiently. And if you're chasing growth at all costs and are unfocused about who you want that growth to come from, I can almost guarantee you'll be highly inefficient about getting there, which I don't think works today anymore.
Agreed. And what I like about that is that you're saying that the pendulum swings very far on all angles. And if you don't find your tribe early, and this goes to early stage investing, if you can find that tribe, and you mentioned the 5 to 10, I think you can find that in the 500K to the 5 million range, mm-hmm. is that once you start to find that buyer and really define that persona, you'll modify a little bit to get to the 5 to 10 million, but that you're so close to hitting that, that this will actually take away from you doing all of this extra work and all these extra verticals of marketing that aren't really hitting you. Find that one person or find that one tribe or group. That's going to make a difference. And my last question to this, and I think we could talk for days on this stuff because I love data and I love the whole concept of what you guys are doing this, is how much of an impact on omnichannel does, I guess, two things. When the brand is trying to figure out what their footprint is, how important is omnichannel, the experience of an omnichannel, how important is that to them early stage versus later on? So would you say that it is a 10 right away, start working on this, start figuring it out, and this layers into brand? So the big question for me is, when Take Flow Hydration, they were a company that we early stage invested in, they were all about brand. And this is what I loved about them. You know, they innovated. So this part B to this is innovation. How much innovation really changes that persona. Mm-hmm. And when they went and took the plastic and turned it into cardboard, that really changed the game. And then they said, you know what? We've changed the game, but we're going to add in one other element, which is there's no brand owning this category. And you mentioned that before, that the brands are all antiquated everywhere and there's not a real category leader. And they said, we're going to be the leader in brand. So we're going to define this. So that's what they went to market with. And yeah, sales were different, slower, whatever. But then boom, they started to get in everywhere because people started to resonate with it. They said, we want you in our store. And then every store started to pick them up. So the brand got picked up because they had that section for innovation, but they also had this real compelling story of how brand made a difference in this category that had thousands of water bottles and thousands of everything. They defined it. So they made that change. So in that omnichannel experience, they were able to really focus in, but they made brand the number one piece to that even early on. So is that type of recommendation that you would say, if you're going to get into this, think about all these things before you start, but here's kind of the stages you have to go through to get to this real winning omnichannel experience.
100%. That is such a beautiful story about the importance of brand. In our view, brand has only become more important, not less. So in the last 20 years, since China has joined the WTO, anybody has access to anything at a commodity level. If you're a smart consumer, you can tap into Alibaba and you can buy unbranded stuff direct from the manufacturer at a fraction of the cost. Why hasn't that taken off? You know, there are business models that have been built around this concept of brand doesn't matter anymore. People just want the cheapest commodity for the lowest price possible. Give that to me. I don't want this baloney around brand. It's quite the opposite. Consumers want brand because brand at the end of the day is an emotional connection with that end consumer. And, you know, where we are on Maslow's hierarchy of needs, we're at the pinnacle at this point for the vast majority of consumers in the US, where most of our basic needs are taken care of at this point. And so a brand has to be that pinnacle of the pyramid, which is the self-actualization piece, which is, do you represent what my value system is and what I stand for? Are you a reflection of me as a human? Because that's why I'm going to lean into your brand. And the brand is part of representing what I am as a human. And that's really what it comes down to. And if you don't have that resonance, nobody has any attachment to what you're doing. And so we think brand has only become more important because in many ways, that's all that's left. So focusing in on your brand, what you stand for, what you don't, who your tribe is, who it's not, that's all that's left in our view. And you know, the consumer space has had an interesting ride over the last 20 years because of the potential commoditization effects of, you know, bringing China, you know, into our supply chain, you know, at a scale that was inconceivable before. So now that that has primarily run its course, we see what the end product is, and the end product is brand's all that's left. So that's why we choose to focus on the things that we do. Having said all that, you know, you also want to make sure that consumers are willing to pay that brand premium. And there is a margin profile that works for various categories. And that got forgotten a little bit over the last 10 years because a lot of people were just focused on the top line. And so for many brands in the last 10 years, we've just seen that, yes, you grew really fast because you were priced unsustainably. And maybe you should have grown a little bit slower, charging a little bit more for what you're doing. And that would have been a truer test of, do people actually care about what this brand stands for? So I think a lot of that is coming to roost today. And you will probably see some brands go by the wayside because, you know, once you've trained the consumer that your product isn't worth that much, it's hard to untrain them on that later, 10 years later. So you got to make sure you start on that process early. And if it's not worth it to consumers, you're better off knowing that early.
Well, that's well shared. That's a great, great last point before we kind of move into the next segment. But Anthony, that was very well shared. Thank you. Great stuff. Great stuff. Okay, we're going to jump into the our 60-second rant. We're going to, I guess the excitement level on my side is that I love this new segment. So we're going to jump into this real quick. So the way it works is I'll give you 60 seconds. I'm going to time it. And you have 60 seconds to go on a rant. And then I'm going to come back with maybe one or two comments. and then you finalize it up. But 60-second rant on anything and anything that you want to jump into.
Yeah, well, I kind of alluded to it earlier, which is the question of what matters more, growth or profitability. I as a capital provider, I cannot stand the binary option of one or the other. To me, in consumer, for brands that stand the test of time, the equation has always been you start with high growth, and over time, that growth rate moderates and it turns into high profitability at a bigger scale. That's the answer. So it depends upon what, when, where, and how you are in your life cycle. Should you be pursuing growth? Should you be pursuing profitability? And you don't know the answer until you understand the unit economics of the business extremely finely to know when you should be making that change. Because no brand can sustain even 50% growth rates forever. The wheels come off operationally, you get beyond your tribe, all kinds of things happen where there is a natural rate of growth at different stages for every brand.
I love it. That was your 60 seconds. That's a great rant. My rebuttal to that would be, how much does venture capital change the way this process that you just talked about operates, because they need to be in and out with their money, paying off their investors within 7 years. They need high growth. So at the end of the day, their goal isn't about building a sustainable business that can go and turn into a Nike or to an Adidas. Their goal is that they need to make their money and be out in 7 years, and they need your brand to go from 100,000 to 100 million in 7 years. So it is about growth. How do you counter that with saying, let's just build businesses that last longer and you don't have to exit from? And is there a whole different way of looking at that?
Yeah. Well, look, we favor high growth too. So it's just the definition of high growth should change as you achieve more and more scale. It shouldn't just be a singular number, because, you know, growing from 2 million to 4 million at 100% is very different than trying to grow from 200 million to 400 million. It's the percentage is the same, but the operational complexity of doing that is monumentally different. So what I would say on the venture side is that the expectations for growth probably need to moderate a little bit, which probably means valuations need to moderate a little bit at the early end, and the quantum of capital that brands need on the early end needs to moderate a little bit. And to make all that math work, efficiency is a critical part of, you know, making a sufficiently high return for early stage venture investors to, you know, see their desired return in 7 years. Do I think it's possible? Absolutely. But you can't throw money at it and hope that growth will solve that problem later. You have to be dialed in about, you know, the right amount of capital for the right stage of the company for the right expectations. So I think that means that what we've seen is that the folks who are still writing checks in the consumer space on the early stage venture side are the ones that have been doing consumer for a long time and not just in the last 5 years.
That's great. And you're right, moderating your dollars in and your expectations. You know, the pendulum swings pretty far. I think in this case, it's saying, let's slow it down. And, you know, you're right, you need to get to 7 years, but maybe the first 2-3 years, you're taking a different approach. And then year 3 to 5, you're taking a much different approach. And then maybe 5 to 7 is where you start to really see the big bump in scaling, because you've taken a slower approach to get to year 5. So instead of just trying to throw money at everything to grow, then maybe take the process in and understanding the strategy, the personas, the value. And then when you do try to double down, your business is ready for it. And you can be able to manage that upside that's going to come to you, especially when you get to 7 to 10 years as well.
I could not have said it any better myself, Jeffrey. That's exactly it.
Done. I'm hitting the red button. Perfect. Record and share. I like it.
All right. Well, that went by pretty fast. I felt like there were times where I was talking way too much, Jeffrey. So sorry if I...
No, you're good. We still got a bit more to go. We got to jump into the rapid fire questions. So we're going to jump into those real quick. And then we're almost there, man. We're getting really close.
Got it. Okay.
All right. So why don't we'll jump into the rapid fire questions, just because we did spend more time chatting and there was obviously a lot of great content there. So why don't we jump into the business side? The way it works, you pick one or the other. So you're coming in, obviously, investor. You choose which one works best for you and your team.
Got it.
All right. First question, founder or co-founder?
I don't know that I have a preference, but I think our portfolio reflects more founder as opposed to co-founder.
Okay. Unicorn or a four-year 10X exit?
Four-year 10X.
Okay. Tech or CPG?
Well, that's an easy one for me. I'll take the consumer all day long.
I love it. NFTs or Web 3.0?
Oh, that's a good one. In the near term, NFTs.
Okay. AI or blockchain?
AI.
First time founder or a second, third time founder?
First time.
First money in or Series A?
In today's world, first money in.
Okay. Board seat or observer?
Board seat, no doubt.
Safe or convertible note?
Convertible note.
Lead or follow?
Lead.
I love it. Favorite part of investing?
I'm sorry, say that again.
Favorite part of investing?
It's never the same any given year.
Number of companies invested per year?
2 to 3.
Love it. I'll say the verticals of focus, but you can just reiterate what those are.
Oh, for us, yeah, everything but food and beverage, really.
Okay. Two qualities a business needs in order to stand out to you?
Brand, unit economics.
Love it. Now I'm going to just a couple quick questions. What piece of advice would you give to business founders 9 out of 10 times?
Seek input from many angles continuously.
What tech will define the world in the next 5 years?
AI.
Who is your hero and mentor or why and why?
Oh, gosh. My father. My father, because is it okay if I don't make this a rapid fire answer?
Yes, yes, yes.
When I was in high school, it finally dawned upon me what he was doing was not easy, because he would typically buy failing businesses, turn them around, sell them in 2 to 3 years, wash, rinse, repeat. So when I was in high school, I asked him two things. I said, Dad, now that I'm old enough, I understand, A, it's not easy to do what you're doing. So I'm two questions. One is, how do you know you can succeed in turning around a business in which you've never had any prior experience? And B, how do you push your chips all in when you're trying to feed a family? And so his answer to the first question was, Anthony, it's about good management. The types of companies I'm buying are really simple. And after I buy them, I spend the first year really understanding how they work. I stop doing the quote unquote stupid stuff that they were doing that I could see from the outside looking in. After that first year, I learn how to grow the business, and I spend the next 2 to 3 years growing the business once I've understood it from the inside. So he said, it's just about good management. And the second piece was, he said, what you're really asking is about courage and risk. And said, the way I view it, I came into this world with nothing, and I'm going to leave with nothing. So everything to me in between is just upside. So if you've done your homework and you believe in the opportunity, why wouldn't you do it? Well, that's when I first stepped back and said, actually, that is the right way to look at it. So hell yeah, that's don't be afraid of failure. If you've done your homework, why wouldn't you do it?
I love it. The advice your father provided is gold. That is fantastic. Totally agree with that. What is your worst investment?
Worst investment. Gosh, let me go back. A fitness club chain in 1999. That was a very regional, localized fitness chain. That was the first investment that I owned as my idea and trying to get it off the ground. And I was 100% right on the macro that fitness was going to become a mainstream activity. I was 100% wrong about the horse we chose as the platform asset.
Fair enough. All right, last question. What's your favorite investment? Well, last question in this segment.
I don't know that I have a favorite because they're all like children to me. I love them all equally, but I think probably one of the most informative ones for me was a company called Oriental Trading Company, which did in February of 2000. So Jeffrey, you're probably old enough to remember the original dot-com bust that happened in March of 2000. So
yes,
I spent a lot of time looking at a lot of e-commerce businesses like e-toys and e-parties and all kinds of stuff that were popping up all over LA. I couldn't make heads or tails of them because I couldn't wrap my head around losing that much money to try to build a company or a brand. So Oriental Trading Company was kind of the opposite, which was I knew that most of the e-commerce companies were burning all their capital on building one-to-one fulfillment infrastructure and customer files. But certain catalog businesses had both of those things, and all they had to do was put a website up. So bought Oriental Trading Company. It was doing $300 million and $40 million of EBITDA. In 6 years, we grew it to $650 million of revenue and $100 million of EBITDA. And that's where I learned all the principles around quantitative marketing and lifetime value and return on investment, because it was a highly quantitatively driven enterprise where let's just say we were mailing at our peak 300 million catalogs a year. And so it had to be a quantitative exercise. But lots of those principles that I learned back then are informed the whole omni-channel approach that I'm using today.
I love it. That's awesome. All right. Super quick, fast, personal questions. Most famous person that pops in your mind?
Michael Jordan.
First brand that pops in your mind?
Aesop.
Book or movie?
Book.
Superman or Batman?
Superman.
Fortune cookie or birthday cake?
Birthday cake.
5 minutes with Bezos or Oprah?
Ooh, I'll take Bezos.
Mountain or beach?
Beach.
Bike or run?
Bike.
Big Mac or chicken McNuggets?
McNuggets.
Trophy or money?
I'm sorry?
Trophy or money?
Trophy.
Beer or wine?
Neither. I'm allergic to alcohol.
Fair enough. TED Talk or book reading?
TED Talk.
TikTok or Instagram?
Ooh. I'll say TikTok.
Facebook or LinkedIn?
LinkedIn.
Favorite movie and what character would you play?
Favorite movie, The Matrix.
I love it.
What character would I play? I don't think I'd be Neo. I think I'd be Morpheus.
Oh, nice. All right, cool. Favorite book?
I'll have to come back to that one. I've got a lot, so I'll have to come back to that one.
Okay. Favorite sports team?
Dallas Cowboys.
Nice. What is the meaning of success to you?
Meaning of success is not external, it's internal. It's doing what I believe I've been put on this planet to do while in a flow state where it's happening through me, and I'm just a conduit.
I like it. And what is your superpower?
Being a jack of all trades, being the master of no field, but being reasonably competent in lots of different areas.
I like it. It's the Swiss Army knife. You bring a lot of value and a lot of great stories and a lot of insight in a lot of different areas, and your past and your experiences certainly dictate that. Well, Anthony, I'm going to say it's been a real pleasure getting the opportunity to dive in and chat with you. As I mentioned, we could probably talk for hours. There's so much great material, and we didn't even get to touch on supply chain operations. There's so many things that tie into this whole data analytics side of investing in CPG brands and the omnichannel. So, and building that tribe. But I want to thank you again for all of your time. And the way we like to end the show is like to give you the last word. So anything you want to share to the investor community, to the startup business ecosystem, we turn it over to you to share. And please share how people can get in touch with you as well.
Yeah, for sure. So, well, first I'd like to share what book that I skipped over. So I have a lot of favorites, but the one I've been recommending the most recently is The Rise of Superman. And it's about achieving flow states in all aspects of your life. And I strongly recommend that to anyone who cares about performance and, you know, optimization in anything that they're doing, regardless of what the field is, including business. So wanted to not leave that open-ended. In terms of recommendation, I don't want to be arrogant and say that we've got it all figured out. I think we have our lens on how we view the evolution of the consumer space. I think it's a somewhat unique lens. And it's certainly not the only way to invest in the consumer space. There's lots of good consumer investors, different approaches, different philosophies. But if understanding your tribe and their omnichannel behavior is the way you think you're headed down, please give us a shout. We'd love to chat. So I'm best reached at, my email is anthony@provenance.digital.
Awesome. Anthony, again, privilege. Thank you very much for all your time today. This was awesome. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Jeffrey. Okay. Talk to you soon. All right. Bye.
Okay. That was a great insights that Anthony provided. And there's a few things that really stood out. I really liked the fact that even in his early startup phase, when he was back in university days, that they were looking for the gap, finding what the demand was, figuring out the value of what they were doing. And when they took that break, kind of how things fell apart, the competition becomes very crucial at this stage as well. And that they commercialized the space, they opened everybody up to turn something that wasn't there into a business opportunity. And then of course, through the whole thing that Providence does, and it focuses on the persona of the customer and figuring out who the tribe is. And once you understand that, that's such a big deal because it allows you to hyper-focus your investment and your time in your business to where you need to focus on getting those customers. And I think understanding that makes such a big difference in growing your business. And of course, in this omni-channel experience, you also have brand that becomes so important. So when you're building this new company, it doesn't matter if you're in tech or CPG or whatever vertical or alignment you're in, is that brand is huge. Brand makes a big difference because that's what helps people resonate with you. And then how you kind of move that into the next stages, which is understanding the persona of each of your customers or the one customer on how you can gain the most in the future. So well shared, the great book too, Rise of the Superman. Another thing to take a look at. But Anthony, that was fantastic. So thank you everybody for joining us today. If you enjoyed the conversation, please feel free to share with your friends, subscribe to our YouTube channel, and or please follow us on Spotify, Apple, and or Stitcher podcast platforms. Feel free to share an audio or video clip around our show, and we may include it in one of our future podcasts. You can find us at marketing@openpeoplenetwork.com or on LinkedIn at Supporters Fund. Your support and comments are truly appreciated. Please visit us at supportersfund.com and or startup events at openpeoplenetwork.com. Thank you and have a fantastic day.